This panel discusses U.S. Department of Homeland Security's detention reform efforts, challenges to reform, civil detention standards, alternative detention models, and alternatives to and alternative forms of detention, the treatment of particularly vulnerable populations, and legal challenges to the U.S. detention regime. Session speakers include Michelle Brenet, Director of Detention and Asylum Program at Women's Refugee Commission, Mary Meg McCarthy, Executive Director, National Immigrant Justice Center, a Heartland Alliance partner, Julie Myers-Wood, former Director, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and President, Immigration and Customs Solutions, LLC, and Margot Schlanger, Officer of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Don Kerwin, MPI Vice President for Programs, moderates this panel. Here's Mr. Kerwin.
I'm Don Kerwin. I'm Vice President for Programs at the Migration Policy Institute. This session is about detention reform. It's called Standards, Alternatives, and Vulnerable Populations. We have a panel that's just an embarrassment of accomplished and expert speakers here. So I'm not going to introduce them at length. You know, don't trust me. Read the biographical materials that you have. But let me just say who they are really quickly. Margot Schlanger, who is to my left here, is the Officer for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the Department of Homeland Security. Prior to her appointment in 2010, she was a professor at one of the very top law schools in the country, right up there with Georgetown, one of the top two. The University of Michigan Law School at Ann Arbor, my alma mater, as it turns out, by coincidence. I did as an undergrad. She's a leading expert on kind of civil rights, prison litigation, and, you know, perfectly suited to talk to us on this issue. Michelle Brenet, who's to my far left, who's the Director of Detention and Asylum Programs at the Women's Refugee Commission. Among other achievements, she has co-authored the Women's Commission's 2007 report on the family detention program called Locking Up Family Values, which was a highly influential report, and a 2009 report on unaccompanied minors titled Halfway Home. Julie Myers-Wood, to my right, is currently president of Immigration and Customs Solution, LLC. We all know that Julie, for 3 years in the Bush administration, directed U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. She's also an advisor, and we serve together on the ABA Commission on Immigration. And she represents, in her private practice, BI Incorporated, which runs the DHS ICE Alternative to Detention Program. So she's really an expert in all things immigration enforcement. And Mary Meg McCarthy, to my far right, is the executive director of the National Immigrant Justice Center. NIJC serves 8,000 persons per year. And Mary Meg heads a pro bono network that represents people in detention and elsewhere of 1,000 attorneys, 1,000 pro bono attorneys, which is really remarkable. They recently released a report called Isolated in Detention, which is on access to legal counsel in detention centers. So I'm going to pose a few questions to our panelists, ask them to speak briefly, but really try, in keeping with the day, to make this a discussion between us and between you. And I think most of you know just to kind of tee up the issue that reform of the detention system has been a priority of the Obama administration almost from the get-go. And I think it's important kind of to lay the groundwork to remember why that is. You know, the detention system has experienced really rapid growth, more than a fivefold increase in detention beds since 1995, and has labored under broad mandatory detention rules, which expanded very significantly, as you'll remember, in 1996. There have been some real reforms of the system over the years, including, you know, the ABA, DOJ, now DHS detention standards, and the real commitment that's been made to promote those standards and adhere to them. The Supreme Court cases on indefinite detention, you know, many pro bono projects, putting minors under the jurisdiction of ORR, I think, was a very positive development, and many more. You know, at the same time, as somebody that used to direct a legal agency that represented a lot of detainees, we've seen the same kind of problems in, you know, report after report for years on detention, whether it was related to a particular population or particular kinds of facilities or whatever. And on an individual level, those people that work in the detention centers, the service providers, there's really endless kind of gut-wrenching individual stories of people, which we could speak about here for hours, but we're not going to do. But I just want to make the point up front that you know, the system needs to be reformed. It really needs to be reformed, and that fact can't be lost in all of the discussion on the timing and the shape of reform. The basic instinct was really important. And the basic insight was this, that DHS, ICE, holds detainees under its civil authorities, right? This is not a criminal population. These are civil detainees. And as the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and many other groups have put it, the detention facilities have traditionally been primarily structured and operated much like standardized correctional facilities, and even the ABA DOJ standards were basically for a criminal population. So in trying to reform the system, DHS has established several priorities, some of which it's met, some of which it's been a little bit slower to meet, but, you know, it's created the Office of Detention and Planning to basically design a civil detention system. It's implementing a nationwide plan to expand alternative to detention programs. The shorthand there, the acronym is ATD programs, if you hear that. It's creating a risk assessment tool to determine who's a flight risk, who's a danger, and who should, you know, where people should be placed in the system accordingly, or even outside the system. It's revising its immigration detention standards to reflect the different types of people that it has in custody. Centralized and supervised management of all of the facilities nationwide, has been renegotiating detention contracts and terminating some, and increasing the priority in terms of monitoring and enforcing compliance over this broad, sprawling network of detention centers, and various other, you know, quite significant reforms regarding medical care, regarding oversight of facilities, regarding the establishment of advisory groups. I think Michelle and Mary Meg actually participate in the advisory group on detention reform. So that's, you know, that's the backdrop. And let me start with Margot to my left here, and kind of a general question. You know, Margot's experience is she's one of the great national experts on civil rights issues related to prisons. And so, you know, from that perspective, what has to happen to make immigration detention reform successful? How far still do we have to go? And what particular civil rights concerns, issues, standards ought to be the focus of immigration detention reform? And I guess the other question is, what is the role people of the Officer for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties in this process?
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me and for giving me a chance to talk about these issues, which are, as you say, near and dear to my heart and central to what my office does as well. So let me start with the first part of your question, which is what is needed to make immigration detention reform successful. It seems to me, as I was thinking about this, that we really need three buckets of things. One is we need clear and appropriate rules and policies and staff and so on, the right staff for the right kinds of facilities, that sort of thing. So this has really been a focus, especially for what I'm going to start to do DHS speak and use acronyms all the time, so I'm going to try not to. But of the 2010 PBNDS, the Performance-Based National Detention Standards, which have been a major effort over, it's now 2011, of course, over the past year or year and a half, to try to get some to think systematically about how can we improve the policies, how can we improve the rules and requirements that govern detention, and how can we get that back out into what used to be 340 facilities but is now down to, I think it's 260 facilities where we house detainees. The 2010 PBNDS are continuing to move. We may someday renamed them the 2011 PBNDS. They're not finalized yet, but they're moving towards being final, and I think a lot of good work has gone into them, and that's been aimed at that first piece, which is what are the rules, what are the policies? The second thing that we need, it seems to me, is we need that the physical layout of detention facilities needs to be conducive to safe and civil type detention. So, for example, you want direct supervision rather than supervision by correctional officers in a little control room. You want something that is as close to normalized as possible. So you want to have congregate eating areas. You want to have a whole lot of things that are civil-like. Now, I say this, and it's a major focus right now with a new facility in Orange County, with additional new facilities that are in progress. I say this, but we do have to say something else. At the same time, ICE has been making a very strenuous effort to increase the use of detention beds for people with criminal histories, as those people are under mandatory detention mostly, are heading towards deportation. And what that means is that even though this is civil detention, our population is more and more likely to have some criminal history. And so we have to keep that in mind as we do this. But it's not... it's not the kind of criminal history that would put people in maximum security or anything like that. And we need to make sure, typically. So we need to make sure that people are in as normalized an environment as is safe and secure. And that's another big feature and one that we're working on pretty hard. The third thing is a set of accountability structures. So routine information collection that relates to compliance with various things, audits, inspections, and a robust complaint mechanism. And again, we've been working very hard on that. So we have these new detention service managers who are on site, on the ground, figuring out in detention facilities that we don't run that things are hopefully running according to plan. We have the new Office of Detention Operations, which does inspections, and we're working on improvements to the inspection process and so on. And my office has undertaken a major rehaul of our civil rights complaints process as well, and is beginning... it's sort of, be careful what you wish for. We're at about twice the level of complaints that are coming in now that we were when I started, which is great in a way, right, because it means that people are beginning to think that maybe there's something useful about that process, but it's a little overwhelming. So we're working on that. So those seem to me to be the important things, and all of that is geared at I don't want to go too long, but all of that is geared at just the issues that you'd think it would be geared at. I mean, the basic goal is safe and humane detention with as civil a flavor as possible. Some of the issues in there are civil rights issues, and therefore they're kind of directly in my lane, but others are not. So, for example, take the food. I mean, food at the outer edges is absolutely a civil rights issue, right? Because if you starve people, that violates their civil rights. But at the same time, we don't really want just minimal compliance with the civil rights obligations governing food. We don't want just you want a nutritionally adequate diet, but you also want, if you're trying to build a civil detention system, you want people to have food that they can pick, and you want them to have food that is comfortable to them. Like you want them not to feel like they have to eat mashed potatoes like in one of those movies, So some of these are civil rights issues and others are not. Those are the main civil rights issues that we focus on, especially medical and mental health care, protection from harm, language access, religious accommodations, access to counsel. I could do this for a while, but you get the idea. There are a lot of civil rights issues that we focus on. And that gets to the kind of question that you ended with, which is what's the role of my office in all of this? Well, ICE is big and my office, CRCL, is small. And that's an important fact for us to remember. We have about 100 people, of whom about two-thirds, maybe a little under two-thirds, work on the kinds of issues that people at meetings like this tend to care about. And working on detention is probably at any given time maybe 10 people in some way, shape, or form. But we do policy work. We've been deeply involved in that 2010 PBNDS, for example, which just takes an unbelievable amount of time that I see a lot of familiar faces here who have also devoted substantial time. But we do policy work. We're leading the creation of a DHS language access plan, for example, which will have a real impact for detention. We also do training. We're involved in training detention service managers. We're involved in training ICE facility inspectors, ICE fact finders. We do a lot of civil rights-related training. We investigate and respond to complaints and recommend appropriate policy or practice changes in response to things that we discover in those investigations. And we conduct NGO and community engagement activities to find out what's going on and make sure that communities and organizations with civil rights concerns have a route into DHS and can have their concerns heard. Now, I want to say about ICE that ICE has very robust engagement with the NGO community, and it's not as if they need us to schedule those meetings. So we do a lot of grassroots community level things, and that can be very useful to getting information back from the ground level. But national level advocacy kind of engagement, ICE is all over that and has been really working hard to make sure that advocacy organizations and NGOs have a seat at a table where something real is going on. And so although my office gets involved in stuff like that, we haven't had to for ICE in detention reform. So hopefully that gets you started.
Yeah, thank you.
Great.
We will come back to some of those issues. So, Michelle, I know that you've done a lot of research and travel on kind of other detention systems, and it's kind of a two-part question. I mean, we know that the current standards come from the American Correctional Association, with kind of a layering of ABA, DOJ, DHS standards, performance measures. However, you know, as we looked at this, there's really no ACA standards for civil detention facilities. And so the question is, are there standards for analogous civil detention populations that we can draw from in, you know, developing standards in the immigration context? And also that you've done research on how it works in other countries and you know, what can we learn from the detention models in other countries, particularly since, you know, particularly, let me ask it in a pointed way, those populations are a lot smaller than ours, too, you know, and some of those models are for 30 people or 20 people, you know, are they analogous, can you know, could they be adopted here? So if you could talk about what we can learn in from other systems in other countries, I'd appreciate it.
Great. The concept of civil detention isn't one that's easy to nail down, especially, as you say, when you talk about standards. The concept of civil detention is really administrative detention, and it does exist all over the world. And increasingly, actually, unfortunately, it's being used for aliens or immigration purposes. Mm. So the United States is certainly not alone in this, and we're not alone in the trend towards greater use of detention, nor are we alone in the use of penal models. So, unfortunately, there's not a perfect example that can be transferred over to the U.S., but I think that there are places that we can look for ideas or concepts of what civil standards should look like. And actually, Margo did convene a while back a great roundtable with ICE and some NGOs and several experts from other areas to provide input on this, people from the juvenile justice world, people from the mental health fields, and from children's homes and those kinds of places that do also need to have set sub standards to regulate their facilities but are not generally thought of as penal. Unfortunately, what I have to say is that I don't think a lot of the great ideas that came out of the discussion have really been implemented to their fullest extent, but some things did come of it. I mean, we're making some progress. There hasn't been a revolution, I would say, but there's been some steps. And then internationally, there are some places to look. They tend to be very general and vague principles and not very specific standards the way we use in the U.S. criminal justice system, which can make it hard to implement and kind of translate into the American way of functioning. But the European Committee for the Prevention of Torture has developed standards for foreign nationals detained under alien legislation. And their main principle that guides it is that that what should be avoided as far as possible should be any likeness to a carceral environment. But there's absolutely no explanation of what a carceral environment is. So, again, that leaves a lot to interpretation. There are also UN standards for minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners, and they have an entire section on civil prisoners. Again, they concentrate a lot on the minimum amount of restriction necessary to ensure safe custody. As Margot mentioned, that becomes a bigger and bigger issue as we have more people with criminal backgrounds in immigration detention, and good order. So again, most of the standards that exist internationally really focus on how you get to minimum restrictions and not kind of what you guarantee. And I think even in the U.S. context, when you look at children's facilities or mental health facilities, a lot of the focus is on human rights and due process procedures in order to remove any liberties. So anytime a restriction is imposed. So it's a little bit flipped from what we have at ICE. And I don't think we've gotten to the point yet where, unfortunately, there has to be a justification for detention. ICE still is functioning on the presumption of detention and a justification for release. So that's one of the big shifts that I still think needs to occur. Mm-hmm. And then I do want to mention that ICE does have something that is the closest we have at ICE to what is considered a civil standard, and those are the family residential standards. I would say that those are still very much based on a criminal standard. They really are just the adult standards merged a little bit with Flores and some other provisions. But they're a step. And I will say that the facilities that they were implemented for, or created for, Hutto, which is no longer a family facility, and the Burks facility in Pennsylvania, are probably now, or at least until the new ones are fully in effect, the closest thing we have to a civil immigration detention facility. And they are more open than the other ones that exist, the traditional ones. So I think we are moving towards something more like that for the more general population. I think the big question is going to be, as Margot has mentioned, one, what kind of people you're going to have in those facilities and how you balance safety versus liberties. And then how those standards, whatever they may be, are enforced, because that continues to be a very big problem in all of our facilities. So really, I think, I mean, the key on the standards for civil detention revolve around proportionality and figuring out how you make that balance.
Julie, kind of three questions.
I get three and the others?
Three, yeah. You don't have to answer all three. You can. So, you know, I'm thinking about the union has very harshly criticized this effort, and I know that it's required kind of going through a process internally of engagement of the union, and may have slowed down some of the timelines here, and I'm wondering, you know, as the former director of ICE, if you could speak to kind of some of the institutional and other barriers that we might not be aware of. To the kind of transition that that is occurring now, or that the administration is pushing for. So that's the first question. The second is, I want to ask you, how different are these civil detention standards likely to be at the end of the day from the current, the 2010 or the 2011 performance-based standards? You know, I mean, we've heard of a couple of differences, perhaps, more meeting space and more open space and less secure. But, what's the system going to look like at the end of the day? And then the third is one that I know that you know a lot about, which is the how effective have the ATD programs been? And what are the comparative costs, compared to, say, detention for these programs, and effectiveness in terms of ensuring appearances as well?
And thanks. Well, I want to say I think that all the work that is being done, not only by the folks at ICE, but also by the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, as well as the NGOs, is really helpful as ICE tries to look at and figure out how can we create a civil detention environment and what is appropriate and what are the standards. And I think one of the challenges that the men and women at ICE face, the good men and women in the union, as well as kind of others, is figuring out what kind of standards will actually work, And it's frustrating to hear about what Michelle has done looking kind of all around the world, and there's not a great model to grab onto. And I think if there had been, ICE would have done that. And it would have been a lot easier, I think, in particular for the folks in the union, who I think are, you know, good civil servants who are trying to do kind of their best job to kind of understand how these reforms in part will work. And when you talk about kind of union opposition to the reforms, I think one of the areas that is worth kind of discussing that I think is a difficult area as we seek to see, you know, how can we make standards that really work and that are appropriate for civil confinement involves kind of officer safety. And, you know, it's one thing if you're talking about serving, you know, having a kind of a salad bar or a choice of an entree. But it's another thing if you're talking about having kind of wires, wires that hang from a flat screen TV that hang down or are plugged in that someone could grab and, you know, choke another detainee or choke an officer on. And so how do you figure out kind of which sort of changes that would be helpful and useful for the detainees are changes that aren't going to impact officer safety? And I think there has been some frustration on the part of the union that not all of that was thought through as well as the union thought it should have been thought through. And I think on the same time, there's been frustration on the part of all the folks at ICE who really wanted these changes and saw the real benefit to these changes, to having better TV access and some of those things, that that they thought it would work and not be problematic. And so officer safety is really, I think, the thing that is troubling in part to the union. And the fact that there aren't good examples other places makes it hard. And these officers feel like they're going to be the ones on the hook. If they're the ones who are in, who are kind of in a particular pod that's a more free pod, that's an open pod, and someone gets a hold of something that's now allowed into the area and then uses it to hurt another detainee or hurt an officer, they're concerned they're going to be on the hook, and how can they manage that? The other concern, I think, that relates to officer safety is the concern that ICE has, ICE agents sometimes have, about not really knowing who it is that's actually coming into your population, not feeling like they don't know enough about the person's potential propensity for violence, their kind of engagement with authority and other sorts of things. And I think this is a particular problem given the changing face of the individuals who are coming to detention. More and more of the population that's coming into detention is coming from the Secure Communities Program, many of whom have been incarcerated. Not all for, mass murders, of course. very few for that. A lot for traffic tickets. A lot in between. So you have people who've been arrested four or five times for assault. Those arrests were dropped for one reason or another. They then come into ICE custody. How are they classified? What sort of safety risks kind of do they pose? And how can they manage it? I would hope, because I know that kind of the folks at ICE in the union and outside the union all want to make this work, that there could be a very constructive dialogue with the union to see how we can do this in a safe way, how we can bring reforms that would be safe for the officers and safe for the detainees and make conditions kind of better in facilities for appropriate candidates. I do think, as Margo mentioned, one of the biggest questions here, though, is who are these appropriate candidates that are going into the less secure facilities? And are these people that really, in fact, need to be confined at all? Or are they people who might be appropriate for an alternative to detention programs such as the ISAP program, or even bonded out or put out on their own recognizance? And you don't want a detention system that's build it, they will come. build it, we'll fill it. That's not what we want to see in our immigration system. And in fact, that's not what we're likely to see given the emphasis on secure communities. So, I think that's really a big challenge. The other institutional challenge that I think the agency has that affects all of these reforms, and, there's so many men and women at ICE that want to do a lot of these things. In fact, we're doing innovative things in some of the facilities that they ran themselves. But one of the challenges they have is as I think both Michelle and Margo noted, ICE has had problems enforcing its current standards. And we're going to have multiple sets of standards, all of which ICE is going to be expected to enforce and enforce effectively. And that raises a real kind of challenge for ICE actually being able to stand up to the task when they are having difficulty in some instances of just kind of managing to the more basic kind of the ABA and the DHS performance-based standards. That's that's not to say it's not the right thing to do. It probably is, but I think that's really an institutional challenge. And a lot of folks at ICE who spent their career there know, gee, are we going to be up for this? Are we setting ourselves up for a situation where we're going to have, five or six different sets of standards, detainees who are moving between classifications all the time, and we are going to be, subject to complaints that we've really kind of missed the boat. To your second question, kind of how will the civil standards be different than the current standards, performance-based standards? I would say that the folks on this panel probably know better than I than I do, because I've not been kind of in on the advisory group. But I'll tell you kind of what I would hope to see. What I would hope to see in the civil standards is, and this might be outside of it, but a real understanding of who exactly we think would be appropriate to be put in there, to be individuals to be in the civil standards. Perhaps people that are subject to mandatory detention, but just by statute, but we think maybe shouldn't be. We think Congress should change it, hint, hint, or something else so that we know what we're dealing with. Looking at how do we deal with the different classifications of detainees, and are we giving them different sorts of freedoms kind of as appropriate? I do think that's going to be very, very challenging to manage, but that's what I would like to see. I would like to see kind of more freedom for the detainees that pose the least risk, and, less restriction on their movement, more ability to kind of do things throughout the day, all those kinds of things. More contact visitation, for people who pose little risk, that's the kind of thing you should see all the time. For your MS-13 gang member, maybe it's not a great idea to have that. So, you hope that the civil standards would really incorporate those sort of things. There's been a lot of talk about making them not feel like correctional standards. And I think that's a really good kind of impulse. Let's not have them feel like correctional standards. They're not correctional standards. They are the civil standards which we are kind of, as the U.S., taking the lead in developing. At the same time, we do have to be mindful that that could create a challenge kind of in enforcement for everyone who's used to enforcing these correctional-like standards. Are we sure that we're giving the training to the folks in Orange County and other places to enforce the civil-type standards and make them understand that that's what they're dealing with? In terms of the alternatives to detention program, I have been privileged to work with BI over the past couple of years and saw when I was at the agency the success that they have. And I think that alternatives to detention, including kind of your bond program, your recognizance program, as well as the traditional what's called the ISAP program, intensive supervision appearance program, have been really incredibly successful and an unsung hero in reducing the risk that ICE has when people are released on their own recognizance and they don't show up to court. Unfortunately, the old 2003 OIG study showed that if people are released on their own recognizance, they have a really high rate of absconding. And so the ISAP program was created and first done by the VERA program, and later BI won the contract. Then it was also run for a while with BI and GEO, and now it's just run by BI. But what that is designed to do is to make sure that people show up at their hearings. They show up at their initial hearings, and they show up at their final hearings. And the program's done a really good job. It has about a 99% appearance rate at your kind of run-of-the-day hearing, you're just a regular hearing. You say, well, what about final hearings? At final hearings, they have a 95% appearance rate. That's significantly higher than what you would see for individuals who are bonded out or on their own recognizance. So for a category of people that pose a slightly higher risk, where there's some risk, ATD kind of works well. Then you think about kind of, well, what's the overall removal number? Are we successful in actually getting those people kind of back to their home country? And there, again, the ATD program is much more successful than a program that involves just recognizance or simply bonding people out. In particular, in the last year, it was 63% of people that were on this program were in final compliance with their removal orders. And you say, wow, that doesn't sound like, detentions numbers, which is 99% or something. Obviously, if you have physical control, you can make sure people get on the plane and go home. But you compare that to the OIG study, which is the benchmark kind of from 2003. They had 80% of people absconded, didn't go home. So 80% non-compliance, 20% compliance versus kind of a 60% compliance. And all of this at a great cost. ATD costs significantly less than similar detention programs. The average cost for ATD is under $7 a day. It's about $6.84. And so the average overall cost for people who are in the program a little under a year, which is about what the program runs, unfortunately, at this time, is about $2,000. At the same time, to detain someone, even for 31 days, is about $3,400. So it's a much kind of less expensive alternative. One of the things I think that this administration deserves kind of great credit for is they're really looking at how can we use this program more effectively? How can we make sure that we're leveraging it for those individuals that might not be appropriate for detention and that we're using it to drive up our removal rates for people who have kind of some particular risk? And I think that flexibility is something kind of that's very positive and useful. One of the concerns that supporters of the program have had in the past is that sometimes the agency will say that ATD is more expensive than detention. And, you know, we run the numbers all the time. You know, we run numbers all the time. We couldn't figure out how could you say that? You know, we were kind of timesing it out and, you know, bringing out the calculator in case my math is just really bad. And the reason is that the agency has been including the cost of removals in the overall cost. Now, how would that affect the cost? Well, for ATD, you have very few, we have nobody who's kind of turned back around at the border or expedite removals, people who are sent home voluntarily. You have a lot more people who are kind of not from Mexico, and you have more expensive kind of travels and return home. And so in my personal view, this is not a view of BI, and in fact, nothing is a view of BI. This is all my own personal view, so don't blame them. It's unfair to count the cost of removal when the individuals who are detained, such a high percentage of those are individuals who are from Mexico or from countries that have very cheap flights or who can take a bus home back home. And so sometimes, if you hear that issue with the cost, that's something I think you should kind of think about and point them back at.
Thank you. Thanks. I think I'm not going to let the audience ask any questions at the end here. I think I'm going to ask all the questions myself. So, because I have a lot of questions. Mary Meg, so you've just done a report on kind of access to justice, legal representation, you know, which spoke to the continued shortage of legal representation to detainees. I wanted to give you kind of an opportunity to speak to some of these ongoing concerns. You found some amazing things in terms of people's access even to, you know, phones and the ability to meet with attorneys and all of that. And I also want to kind of talk about this issue. I believe that it's John Morton who said, you know, we've got 33,400 beds and we're mandated to fill those beds. You know, that's what Congress is requiring us to do. And I guess my first question is, you know, do you agree with that, you know? But the second question has to do with the Julie's issue of the risk assessment. You know, what does that do? What does that mean vis-a-vis use of the risk assessment and kind of as a tool to make detainee placement decisions? You know, if you could speak to that a bit, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. It's really wonderful, and there are a lot of my colleagues in the audience and on this panel who've been working very hard on this issue over the years. And I think, like Michelle said, we're really hopeful, but we feel like now is the time to really implement some of the reforms that we've been talking about for years. And as we see this dramatic increase and explosion of the number of people caught in the immigration system, as discussed in the prior panel, we are just being crushed with people who need access to legal services. And in this report that we did, and I brought a few copies if people are interested, and there's some information in your packet regarding our findings, we found that nearly 90% of the immigrants held in immigration detention have either no access to legal counsel or very limited access to legal counsel. The government spends $5.9 billion detaining immigrants and 0.07% dollars in terms of that money is spent in terms of ensuring that people have access to legal information regarding their rights. It's just astounding. And as we've increased the number of people who are caught up in this immigration enforcement detention system, we haven't combined it with corresponding procedural protections. As I'm sure many of you know, as an immigrant in immigration proceedings, you don't have a right to court-appointed counsel, to appointed counsel. And we're seeing all these individuals, vulnerable individuals, sometimes U.S. citizens caught up in the system, who have no access to legal counsel and end up being deported wrongly. The system needs to be addressed. And as we indicated in this report, there are a lot of things that the government, this administration, can do now to fix that. And one of the major, major pieces that can be done is, as we talk about reform of the detention system, is not place these facilities in remote areas of the country. My colleague Laura in the earlier panel was so wonderful in her description of where they have to go in Atlanta, Georgia, to provide legal services to the detained immigrants. I think she mentioned 3 or 4 different states. We face the same issue in the Midwest. And to have people in these isolated areas, remote areas of the country, and deny them access to legal information and legal counsel is really a travesty of justice. I heard someone say, well, they don't have any legal relief. And that is so far from the truth. Many of these individuals, in fact, you know, working with these with detained individuals, we see case after case of individuals who do have legal relief. But they weren't aware of that. And we're seeing people who are detained who should either be released or be placed in alternatives to detention. The other thing that's really important when you talk about not having appointed counsel is, and being located in a remote area, how do you reach out to get help? And we found in our study that 78% of the detention population included in the phone survey were housed in facilities prohibiting lawyers from having private calls with clients. So individuals who were even able to identify a lawyer weren't able to have the confidential attorney-client phone calls. And many of these lawyers, obviously, were not able to travel 4, 5, 6, 7 hours to reach that individual for a consultation or for representation. Our second recommendation is to increase the legal orientation programs that are available through the Department of Justice. That is so important. And as Department of Homeland Security looks at immigration detention reform, I can't stress enough the critical importance of working with the Department of Justice and making sure that wherever these new facilities are placed or wherever you decide to house immigrant detainees, that there are legal orientation programs. It's fundamental. It's basic. So hopefully this report will serve as a guide to the administration, to members of Congress, in terms of ways that we can fix the system. But I want to go back to the second question that Don raised in terms of the 33,400 beds. I think this is an opportunity for the administration to look at that and say, look, we are required to maintain 33,400 beds. The administration doesn't have to fill every one of those beds. They have to have them available. Many contracts in the Midwest, these contracts are with county jails. They're set up on a per diem basis. Fill the detention facilities that are not that way with the serious, dangerous criminals. And the other individuals, I think, are totally, totally eligible for alternatives to detention, orders of supervision, or release in their own recognizance. We can't fix an immigration detention system while it's exploding. It's impossible. So we have to really look at how do we manage the system? How can this administration go to Congress and say, look, we've reduced the number of detained immigrants. We still ensure compliance with immigration proceedings, and we're saving taxpayers' dollars. This is an opportunity for the Department of Homeland Security to move forward with Congress and take leadership on this issue. And I think Julie's comments reflect that it's possible, but we have to be committed to it. In terms of, I think the other question, Don, you mentioned was the risk assessment tool. And I think this tool has been piloted, and I have to give the administration a hand. They've really worked hard. We've worked very closely with them to really create a tool that is workable. And I think it's hopefully going to be rolled out within the next year and implemented across the board. I'm a little concerned we talk about who's going to be detained with secure communities, because I think, as we heard in the prior panel, we're not seeing the dangerous, serious criminals caught up in the system. We're seeing people who maybe 10 years ago had a crime, maybe had a DUI, as people have talked about, but you know what, have stopped drinking, but got stopped for a traffic offense, for driving without a license. Are those the people that should be in detention? No. Those are the people who should be either released in their own recognizance or an alternative to detention program. And hopefully this risk assessment tool will do that. I think it's really concerning when we talk about a broad definition of criminals to include individuals who have a speeding ticket or driving without a license. Most of us have received a speeding ticket, but we don't consider ourselves criminal convicts. I think it's also really concerning, and this goes back to Michelle's point about transparency. In the Department of Homeland Security website on secure communities, we're not talking just about people who've been convicted, but people who've been arrested. And those are the individuals caught in the system without ever having due process regarding their criminal conviction. So I think this risk assessment tool can be used, and I think it will show that the people who are being brought into the system aren't the serious, dangerous criminals that many times we've been led to believe.
Yeah, go ahead, Julie. Yeah.
I just wanted to respond to one a point made about kind of the number of detention beds and kind of ICE having to kind of fill those beds. That is an area where Congress can really be of help. I mean, I think that the agency was really on the hook. Director Morton and others were dragged up a number of times up to the Hill. You know, how are you doing? How many beds are filled? And that was based in large part on language in the House Appropriations bill that they put in, I think, not liking it, but put in as part of a budget deal. And that's something that really needs to be dropped, because I think they feel that they would love to not have that pressure, but they feel that that pressure is there. And so that's something where I think staff members, members of Congress, mm-hmm. could really help out a lot. And then you could make wise choices, not just fill the numbers.
Right. I mean, it's very perverse. Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. It just creates a real perverse conflict,
absolutely.
I think.
Yeah. Let me ask, let me pose a couple of questions that have occurred to me. Yeah.
Just before you do that, I kind of need to respond to one thing that Mary Medquist said.
Can you do it quickly?
Sure.
Yeah.
ICE does not think that people who have speeding tickets are criminals. Let me just say that again. Like, I mean, that's just not right. That's not what the secure communities program does. Is it deals with people who are arrested, that's true. And depending on when those statistics are done, ICE sometimes classifies people as in level one or level two based on the arresting charge. Although they say this was the arresting charge. So by the time they're up to people who are being deported, if they call somebody, if we at DHS call somebody a criminal offender, that's because they have a conviction. Now, that's not true if it's arrest statistics, but if it's deportation statistics, at the point of deportation, we know whether people have been convicted or not. And if you look at those statistics, you'll find that the ones who are classified as criminal offenders are in fact criminal offenders. And that doesn't mean a speeding ticket. It may mean driving without a license in a jurisdiction that has made driving without a license a criminal offense. But you don't get arrested for speeding tickets, so you're not in secure communities on a speeding ticket anyway. And you certainly aren't classified as a criminal because you have a speeding ticket. So I'd like to say that I got my last speeding ticket last year, and if I were here in a deportable status, it would not have gotten me deported. It's just, I mean, that's just not how it works. So
you're saying, yeah.
Perhaps. Yes, well, driving without a license in some jurisdictions is a criminal offense, and if it is a criminal offense, then we classify it as a criminal offense.
So nobody is coming into secure communities based on speeding tickets?
Into secure communities based on their getting fingerprinted. So
After being arrested for speeding.
No, you don't get arrested for speeding. So you can't have your fingerprints taken.
Yeah.
But I do, actually. You don't get arrested for speeding. Now, if you're speeding, and when somebody pulls you over for speeding, it turns out you don't have a license, you might get arrested for driving without a license, where you got detected for speeding. You also might get arrested for armed robbery, where you got detected for speeding. People come into the criminal justice system a variety of ways.
So you're driving 100 miles an hour down the road, the cops pull you over, you're not arrested?
I don't know if you can get arrested for driving 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
But I'm not aware of jurisdictions that arrest people for speeding. And if they don't arrest you, you can't be fingerprinted and you're not in secure communities.
So we're not talking about secure communities. We could do a whole session on secure communities. I think everybody would love that. And I've actually been in those already. But let me ask two major questions that occur to me on kind of the detention reform issue, two major challenges related to reform. The first is this issue of the different types of population in custody, because it's definitely true that there are some very serious, you know, people in custody. I mean, we knew that when we represented them. We didn't want them in certain blocks and certain cells, okay? So, you know, the question is, and I can understand why ICE wants to be careful that they don't have to manage to seven different kinds of populations, and they don't want kind of gangbangers and, you know, unsecure facilities and all of that. So, that, you know, that's I think that's a big challenge. How does the increasing detention criminal population, how does it affect the creation of a civil detention system and the facilities as a result? And then the second big issue, which I think is system-wide, is how do the broad mandatory detention rules impact reform of the system, right? I mean, you have to detain large numbers of people ever since 1996. An alternative to detention, alternative to detention programs are still not viewed as alternative forms of detention. In other words, all of those mandatory detainees have to be detained. They can't be put in these alternative programs. So those, to me, seem to present, you know, fairly significant challenges to kind of reform of the system. I wonder if, you know, anybody would want to talk to those two.
I'd like to speak to the first one. It is an ordinary challenge of a jail and prison system that different kinds of people with different criminal histories and different risks, either risks that they might cause violence or risks that they might be victimized by violence. It is an ordinary feature of a confinement system to have to manage those kinds of varied populations. That's what classification is all about. And ICE's classification system needs to be up to that challenge. And I think that's not a unique challenge. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the one that is right now taking the energy and occupation of people interested in reform, because I don't think that one is as unique, and it's not it's not something that we don't know how to do. Mm-hmm. What I will say also is, and maybe this is because I do come from a prison reform background, I've spent a lot of time in very tough prisons, and very tough prisons, much tougher by, you know, sort of general population criminal history than ICE detention is, can still be managed in a way that is humane and safe. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to make facilities feel less penal if you're interested in doing that, even with very difficult populations. Again, much more difficult than our populations tend to be. Direct supervision is a strategy that every facility I've ever been to that uses it, and I've been to a lot of facilities that use it, every one of them that I've talked to people about the transition, the officers have said, oh my God, you don't really mean that we're going to be in a setting with 64, 59, 72, whatever the number is, it varies, of unconfined inmates with no weapons, and we're just us and them, and like we're going to die on the first day that we try that. And the answer is that direct supervision has, in study after study after study, been proven to be a safer form of confinement because the correctional officers are where the problems start, and they can dampen down problems before they escalate. Now, that's true. That's a civil type. It's a civil type supervision mode that we can learn from. Notwithstanding Michelle's, you know, very well taken point that there's not so many civil detention versions out there for us to learn from, we can learn from direct supervision
could you explain what that is, though?
Oh, sure.
I'm not totally clear on what that means.
So direct supervision is a model, a penal model, just to be clear. It's a penal model in which the correctional officers are in with the prisoners in usually it's like a day room. And the prisoners have access to the day room, and they have some relative free flow of movement. They're not moving between buildings. They're not moving long distances, but they have free access to the day room, and they can move around. In some prisons, they can move between buildings. But a jail direct supervision model has them in and out of cells, into the day room, able to go and make phone calls, able to go to little rooms where there's rec, able to do various things, with one or sometimes two, depending on how many people it is, correctional officers in the space with them at all times. That's the basic idea. Not behind a wall, not with clanging doors, not with controlled access in and out. It's just mixed in with them. And it is a civil-type model because it allows more freedom of movement. And we can learn from that, and we can manage the population that's coming in. I don't want us to pretend that because we have a more likely criminal population coming into our detention facilities, that means, oh, my God, we better just put them all in max. Like, we just don't need to do that. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to add that I think one of the things that there are models of from the civil context are more case management systems, which is kind of a parallel to what you were just discussing, which is more not the decision makers, not guards, but people who are dealing one-on-one with the detainees, who know who they are, know what their needs are, know what their problems are, and that can really mitigate a lot of the issues that come up before they become problematic. And they can lead to being able to identify, if they're not identified at the very initial risk assessment phase, who doesn't need to be in there.
Mm-hmm. And how
and
is
who
that,
you can move out.
But how is that different from, say, like the deportation officer, the case management? I mean, how, because there is a function that's akin to that or analogous to that now, right?
The key difference is that it's not a decision maker. The case manager is not somebody who's deciding whether you're detained or not, and they're not deciding your case, and they're not deciding, you know, what happens when you go to court. They are making recommendations, and they're working with you, and they have a social work background usually, or more of a that sort of background as opposed to a criminal justice background.
Okay.
And that's really important, I think, in terms of the relationship and how the process works. And I just want to, one more thing on the size issue, because obviously one of the biggest, I think, resistances to that is cost and numbers. We have, 32,000 people locked up. In Australia, what they did is they actually prioritized. And so they do a screening, and the more vulnerable cases get the case managers. And that might be more vulnerable, might be that they're more likely to be violent, or it might be that they're more likely to be at risk of violence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So more case management, more open space, more direct supervision. Do we keep the basic infrastructure, most of the basic infrastructure?
I don't think so. I think we really need to start with a whole different model. If we keep the correctional, like, physical facility model, we're just replicating the correctional model. I mean, I have to add this, not that I'm advocating for this, but, some of our clients who've come from the Bureau of Prisons to immigration detention have been treated worse in immigration detention than they were treated in the Bureau of Prisons. And so, I'm not advocating for a Bureau of Prison model, but I just think we really got to take a step back and look at how the immigration detention system is set up and how do we really implement some meaningful civil detention reforms. And even though there's not a perfect model out there in other parts of the country or the world, like Julie was saying, we can create that. We can be a model here in the United States, and we shouldn't be afraid of that. And I think, again, echo what Michelle said, Margo pulled together a wonderful meeting. I wasn't there, but my colleagues were. It was just a really a good meeting talking about how you create small pods, how you create a facility that's civil in nature and not a correctional facility that then fits in with a case management model that fits in with a process for people either to be repatriated, deported back home, or to remain in the United States with the mental health treatment, the whatever they need because of their particular vulnerability or whoever they are, where they've come from.
I think one thing that would be really helpful in implementing kind of these sorts of changes is, and I don't think ICE necessarily is going to get this, but is funding to kind of continue to bring in kind of new officers that may not have the correctional background. A lot of people that end up in ERO are people that come from the correctional background are very comfortable in it. They've worked in that for 30 years. You know, they know, they go to all the ACA conferences, et cetera. You know, maybe kind of bringing in some different kinds of perspectives, people who obviously would be competent to serve as the case managers or to serve as to serve and do direct supervision alike, that would be helpful. But people who have a different mindset from the beginning, I think that would be helpful. I mean, that's obviously very tough in this budget environment, but I think that could kind of make a big difference. I would say, though, to Margo's point, I'm glad to hear you say that you think that ICE does not think that classification is a challenge. I guess my experience has been a little bit different, that they did have kind of a hard time just with the classification system that ICE previously had. So that's not a great sign. And a lot of challenges in looking at the number of people who are charged with things and then the arrests are dropped, and dealing with those individuals. There's a very high number of individuals who are charged with kind of serious crimes. Those arrests are dropped. Not talking about driving without a license, but something else, you know, because of overburdened county or state facilities, and that are put into ICE custody, and how those people are managed and how those they are classified and how they are treated. I think that's going to really be kind of a growing challenge. I think for the folks who are arrested for driving without a license, I don't know how many of them are detained right now or not. Somebody else on the panel may know, but I think in thinking about kind of, you know, who else are we detaining? Are we detaining everybody that has a drunk driving conviction, for example, you know, because of kind of some of the horrible incidents that have happened? You know, are there alternatives for those sort of people? And I think to Don's point, thinking about, are there ways that we can use alternatives to detention as a form of detention may make sense. You know, many of us, probably all of us on this panel, think that Congress may have gotten it wrong in how they defined mandatory detention. You know, I don't think they're likely to change that tomorrow. But what the agency has an ability to do, I believe administratively, would be to look at an alternative to detention as a mandatory detention. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a challenge, big institutional challenge, big institutional hurdle in that. Then you're going to have Zavadas challenges for people who are on, you know, electronic monitoring. So there are reasons why I think the agency would be concerned about that. But I think given the increase from secure communities and given, frankly, the, you know, I think last year it was like, I thought it was like 22% of the people they called criminals had traffic offenses or something. It was something that was surprisingly high. I think it makes sense thinking about it.
Yeah, we should start to take questions, so I'm not going to ask all the questions. So please, if you have questions, come up. But go ahead, Michelle.
I was just going to say that there actually is an example regarding that mandatory detention and alternatives in Australia, yeah, where what they did administratively, again, because they were in a very similar situation in which they didn't think there could be a legislative fix, is they stated administratively that they could determine what custody or detention was. And even something like house arrest or somebody's having to live in a certain apartment, but being able to come and go during the day could be considered custody.
I mean, why? What's the legal argument that these super secure kind of alternative programs, and you can ramp up the security, you know, so that there's, you know, nobody. You have bracelets on people, you have monitoring mm-hmm. devices, you have reporting. You have. Why isn't that considered a form of detention legally? I mean, I don't even understand that.
Well, I might add, it is under the federal habeas corpus statute. So, you know, it's some deprivation of liberty, but it doesn't have to be physical custody. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a fair interpretation, legal interpretation, that could be applied.
It has been litigated a couple of places where they see has been successful in saying it's not. But I think because and the reason for the agency's thinking has been kind of the institutional challenges it would bring. But
I
now
see.
We're going to that's right. But now we're going to face some kind of practical limitations. Mm-hmm. Congress is not going to be extending the bed numbers to the number of people coming out of secure communities. How are we going to monitor those folks? How are we going to deal if the number of people that are mandatory detention is much higher than the number of beds? And not all of them should be detained.
Right. So, questions? And if you could identify yourself, please.
Hi. Peter Orr with the National Labor Relations Board. A question I have is on these ATDs or bonds or releases, unless these individuals have a right to work authorization, you know, it may be a better alternative than being locked up for a year or so before the deportation action is completed. But what's going to happen to these individuals? They're going to have to work. Isn't that just encouraging them to break further laws eventually and then become, you know, categorized as a criminal?
The question is, if they're on alternative programs, there's going to be incentive for them to work, and they're going to be
released. So what are they going to do for the year or so while the deportation action is going to go through? They're going to have to support themselves one way or the other.
I'll start with that, if you want to jump in. I mean, in some cases, people can receive work authorization, and I think that's a very critical point, because if you are going to be without the without permission to work for extended periods of time, one of the, I think, actually almost worse than the size issue for the United States is the challenge of a lack of a social welfare system that you have in many other countries. So a lot of the countries that I've looked at who use alternatives to detention do provide, they provide housing, they provide medical care, they provide all of these things for people who are on these programs, and it's not controversial in their society because it's what everybody has. Whereas I think in the United States, you have this challenge of either you need to let them work, or if you're giving them so-called benefits, you're going to have the uproar that they're getting things that U.S. citizens do not get, which, you know, is a justified concern.
I only want to add one thing, which is that the average length of stay in detention is 37 days. So when people are out, it's for a year, but it's 30-something days when people are in detention on average. That doesn't mean there aren't people who are there for a long time, but Zavidas in particular has been a pretty big push towards getting people out.
That's true, but also I think one of the challenges is that sometimes it's a false comparison because you have 37 days, but you have all of the expedited removal cases are in detention.
None
of those, you know, versus, you know, a lot of the traditional 240 cases, mm-hmm. those people are either out on their own recognizance, people that have administrative reinstatements, people that do stipulated removals, so very high numbers of people that are able to really drive that time period down. But Margaret's absolutely right. I think the agency and DHS have made a lot of progress in bringing that time down, but they have a lot of administrative help that you don't have for the non-detained docket.
What's about a quarter of them are a day or less. Mm-hmm. And there are about, when we looked at about 4,000, and I think that's still the number that have been in detention for more than 6 months, which is pretty, you know, pretty significant. Although you don't have the kind of big populations that you had in the past, the Vietnamese, the Cubans, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Rich Dan at GAO. It seems like there are a lot of forces coming together here that are going to present real management challenges. You know, the FTA, the failure to appear rate, skyrockets when you don't detain. And that fact is probably not going to be lost on people if we go to a model that sort of exacerbates that. On the other hand, it's no secret we're in a real fiscal straitjacket. I think ERO and ICE did very well in fiscal 11, holding their breath for fiscal 12 like everybody else. State and locals, where you have contract facilities, it's either cutting police, fire, and teachers or having a nice, you know, I don't know how. Do you have any thoughts, you must have given this some thought, about how you manage in these impossible situations to try to make sure that you have the legal requirements, you're not constantly in consent decree status, that you are fiscally responsible, and that there you don't have the perception problem that you have a 9-10% unemployment rate and you have folks getting cut out and they're on the street for whatever reason, tales of woe, and yet your detained inmate has a choice of food. You know, it's a potential perception problem that you're going to get some investigative reporter who's going to make a lot of hay out of that kind of a situation.
Well, fortunately, GAO will back the agency for all the reforms. It's always good. Rich Santa, who, you know, did oversee all the ICE things when I was there, it's always good to be on a different side of, you know, not in front of him for questioning or something. I think there have been some kind of perception issues with the softening of the facilities. I was at a hearing on medical care when I was at ICE, where, you know, I was questioned about Cadillac medical care that we were giving to detainees. And ICE, frankly, is, I think, an unwinnable position on that. I think there are these things that are very important to look at that make a lot of sense, you know, thinking about direct supervision, thinking about when I was in a facility, one time I was asking people, well, what do you really need? What do you want? Somebody wanted, you know, conditioner. That would make the difference, all the difference in the world for us is conditioner. You know, we got conditioner, you know. So, like, thinking about how can you make it more kind of humane for people? And you're going to take hits from the other side. I mean, you just are, just as they do sometimes, I think, in the penal system. What I think would be helpful is, though, to think about, you know, looking at how can ICE keep better track of the people that are just bonded out, of the people that are on alternatives to detention, including telephonic reporting bracelets, people that are on its own recognizance. You know, there's 500,000 people in this country that ICE has lost track of that are immigration fugitives. You know, that number can't just continue to grow. So, you know, how is ICE going to be more effective in kind of telephonic reporting or other things? And I think the agency, to its credit, is really looking at where the flexibility is. Could we put people on ATD for a short amount of time, then take them off, and then put them back on? The question is, how is that going to affect the outcomes? And now if all of a sudden you have, you know, a higher number of people who are on ATD who aren't going home, then there'll be complaints on that side. So, you know, I would hope, since I'm out, I can say I would hope that GAO would be would be one of the places that I think could give the agency kind of some support as they try to do, you know, the balance, not looking to put individuals in luxury resorts, but making sure that we're meeting our obligation to treat people humanely.
But, I mean, I just want to, add that, and Julie's already said this, but it's not really true that people who are released don't show up. If they're released without any assistance, without the right information, yes, we've seen these huge rates of absconding. But, you know, as she already stated, people who are in ATD programs, and there's various levels of this. I mean, it could be just a occasional check-in. It could be helping somebody get an attorney, and once people have attorneys, they are much more likely to succeed. I mean, I think there are a lot of levels of alternatives that are much, much cheaper, so they're fiscally, you know, more responsible, that still do get people to their hearings and to leave if they have to leave.
And just to be clear, even softer civil detention is not a charming resort-like area, right? We're sort of talking about approaching the kind of situation of, you know, like a jury service room. Like, just think about you. Just, like, we're not talking about charming, you know. We're talking about not being locked in your cell all day, but instead being able to sit at a table with three other people all day. So I just, like, we're not getting to, you know, luxury resort area. We're not even getting to within sight of luxury resort area. We're talking about keeping it from feeling penal and keeping it at, you know, like, bureaucratically boring and uninviting. So,
but I mean, do we have an obligation not to be bureaucratically boring? I mean, I'm very supportive of kind of all the things we're doing.
No, I think we are bureaucratically boring. That's what we're aiming for.
There we go.
Right? The goal is boring rather than unsafe.
Y'all heard it here.
Yeah, right.
that's what we're about here. That's where we're headed. And the jury room is the new model.
Yeah, right. I just want to add one other thing, too. And this is from our experience. We're seeing a lot of people, again, who are caught in the system who do have legal relief. And so how do we move those cases? Or for those individuals who don't have legal relief, do we need to have them detained for the length of time that they're detained and waiting to get into a courtroom, which is now 3, sometimes 6 months, even detained? Why don't we look back to what we had pre-96, which was voluntary departure? And I know the law shifted. You know, people are thinking removal orders, it's deterrence. It's not a deterrent. I mean, I think there's some administrative fixes that we can look at in this overall system. You know, people aren't consular processing because of the unlawful presence bar, and can we adjudicate those waivers here so that they don't go back instead of our office fighting a cancellation or removal case? So, and again, that person's detained 6 months, a year, going through the court system. So I think there's some fixes, to your point, within the system that can be made administratively without congressional intervention at this point, that can make it more fiscally positive, that can reduce the detention, and that really changes perceptions.
Thanks. And I'm just going to ask Margo one final kind of question since we have her here, and that is, could you speak a little bit about, you know, you talked about the influx of civil rights complaints from the detention system. What are some of the patterns that you're seeing coming in?
Well, we've recently seen a rather major and put together complaint coming from Mary Meg about sexual abuse and sexual assault involving gay, lesbian, and transgender detainees. So that's a big one that just hit. But I would say, you know, what we see is we see a bunch of failure to protect kinds of claims of people who were assaulted or abused sometimes by correctional officers, but more often by other detainees. We see always medical care. Some of those we look into and we find that these are people who are members of what my doctor calls the worried well, and they're in detention and they're really anxious, and actually their medical care is just fine. But sometimes we find that there are real problems, and we are a part of the system of trying to address those problems. We also see language access issues. People who don't speak English, and especially, I'd say, people who also don't speak Spanish. People who don't speak either English or Spanish, and sort of how they get their communications needs met. These are issues that we see a fair amount. So we're working rather systematically on all three of those kinds of issues to try to address the underlying problems, as well as dealing with the onesie, twosie, or by 13s, like Barry Meg's complaints, to address the complaints as they come in.
Thank you. I'm getting the chop signal from Andy here, who's up next. If you all could, you can stand up, but you can't leave. Okay? Stay in this room. We're going to talk about right to counsel. And thank you to this terrific panel that we've had.
For more information, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/U.S. immigration.